After he failed to show up for a deposition, the House January 6th committee moves to hold Steve Bannon in criminal contempt. The question is, will the other Trump allies who've been subpoenaed appear before the committee? Plus, an FDA advisory panel recommends emergency use authorization for a booster dose of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. The question is, could millions of Americans be one step closer to getting an additional shot? And a local reporter puts the rest of us to shame by skateboarding during his stand-up. We'll tell you what inspired that live shot while I ask the question, where did I leave my board? It's way too early for this. Good morning, and welcome to Way Too Early, the show that would probably land itself in the emergency room if it tried that. I'm Jonathan Lemire on this Friday, October 15th. We'll start with the news. Former President Bill Clinton has been hospitalized in California with a non-COVID-related infection. A spokesperson for the former president said in a statement that Clinton is, quote, on the mend, in good spirits, and is incredibly thankful to the doctors, nurses, and staff providing him with excellent care. A source close to Clinton tells NBC News that he is in intensive care as a precautionary measure and that his original infection was diagnosed as urologic, but then morphed into a broader one. Clinton, who is 75 years old, also has an extensive history of heart problems. The House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection announced yesterday that it will move to hold former Trump advisor Steve Bannon in criminal contempt for not complying with its subpoena. According to Chairman Benny Thompson, the panel will meet on Tuesday to vote to adopt a contempt report. He released a statement saying in part this, the select committee will use every tool at its disposal to get the information it seeks, and witnesses who try to stonewall the select committee will not succeed. In an interview with CNN yesterday, the congressman said a subpoena for the former president isn't off the table.
A lot of what we decide on former President Trump is dependent on what we find in this information.
Are you ruling out or ruling in the possibility of eventually subpoenaing Trump?
Well, I would say this at this point. Well, nobody is off limits to a subpoena from this committee.
Meanwhile, the committee is delaying depositions for three other former Trump administration officials. According to the committee, Kash Patel and Mark Meadows will have their depositions postponed as they, quote, continue to engage with our investigation. The deposition for Dan Scavino, meanwhile, has also been moved due to a delay in delivering his subpoena. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked yesterday about the administration's decision to refuse former President Trump's request for executive privilege when it comes to January 6th. Here's what Jennifer said about that.
There was an insurrection on our nation's capital. What we're talking about here is getting to the bottom of that. Shouldn't everybody want to get to the bottom of that? Democrats, Republicans, people who have no political affiliation whatsoever. I will reiterate that we're going to assess and review, as is standard in the process, the documents and any efforts to exert executive privilege on a case-by-case basis.
Psaki was also asked if this set a precedent for future presidents not cooperating with executive privilege with Biden. Her response, President Biden had no plans to launch an insurrection at the Capitol. Joining us now, White House correspondent for Politico and co-author of The Playbook, Eugene Daniels. He's also an MSNBC contributor. Eugene, good morning. Nice to see you today. I know you were traveling with the vice president in recent days. The January 6th committee is moving to hold Bannon in contempt. What kind of precedent do you think this sets for other Trump allies who've been subpoenaed? Do you think the DOJ will actually move ahead with this prosecution? How do you see this playing out? What do we think Bannon's next move might be? And what about Patel, Meadows, and Scavino?
Yeah, I think what the committee is hoping to do is make very clear to everyone that, hey, you cannot ignore us, right? You cannot just listen to the former president who is saying that he is declaring some kind of blanket executive privilege that maybe doesn't exist in order not to comply with what we say. That is what the committee is saying to everyone. And I think they're using Bannon specifically because he's probably the least likely to be helpful in an actual deposition. They've kind of gone through this process before with him during the Russia investigation. Congress has, and so they know he's unlikely to give them a lot of information because he is so loyal to President Trump and the entire MAGA movement, right? His next steps Pence are probably to continue to stonewall. I have a hard time seeing Steve Bannon actually just come and sit and talk. And if he does, he'd probably do something maybe similar to what he did when during the Russian investigation. He came to one a skiff talk and was, they said, Adam Schiff said he was completely unhelpful. And then he came the next time with a list of questions that he would only answer. And all the answers, I think Adam Schiff said, were no, they were already answered. And I think that is kind of the kinds of things he's done before. And maybe we can expect again, whether or not the DOJ is interested in moving forward. It's likely, right? Like this is an administration. First of all, the White House has made clear, very, very, very clear, that President Biden is staying out of this and allowing Congress and allowing the DOJ to handle this, making clear that there's a huge separation between the DOJ and the White House. But this is a DOJ that has wanted to make clear to folks that the norms are back. You know what I mean? The rule of law is back, and so they have a lot to think about when it comes to the criminal contempt, which can also take a really long time, right? And this isn't something that usually is over in a month. This could take months and even years, depending on how former President Trump acts interacts with privilege and fights in court, and also, more importantly, Steve Bannon.
Yeah, Bannon's relationship with Trump has been an interesting one to chart. He obviously was brought in near the end of Trump's campaign, was seen as one of the real leading forces behind his victory, was in the White House for a brief time, got fired, then fell out of Trump's good graces because he talked to a bunch of authors for a book, but then slowly worked his way back in and was a key figure in 2020 unofficially as a Trump advisor. And the two men have started talking again. So this, speaking of the former president, Eugene, I mean, this is the big question here. Is what do we think? We just heard from Chairman Thompson. Do we expect the committee to actually go after Donald Trump?
It's one of those questions that even when you ask them kind of behind the scenes, they aren't trying to give a lot of answers on, which leads me to believe that they are interested in it, right? They want to hear from everyone in this process. For those that, you know, aren't like us and pay attention to every single investigation that happens on Capitol Hill, you know, they don't start with the big kahuna, right? They're going to move and try to get as much information as they possibly can from everyone else. And then if necessary, ask or compel, subpoena former President Trump. And I think something that they know, we all know, is that, you know, President Trump is loose with the truth, right? He sometimes lies, he obfuscates. And I think that's one of the things they know. They probably aren't sure how much actual honesty and truth they're going to get from him. So that's definitely weighing on them as well. If they can do this without him, I think they will. But I also think that if they get to the end and they need to know exactly what President Trump said and exactly who he talked to and all of that, that they're going to be willing to do. And I think that will be something, it will be something unprecedented. And I think something that will be very interesting, to say the least, for all of us in this country to watch.
Eugene, it's only 5:08 a.m., and you've already hit the Understatement of the Day award with calling President Trump, quote, loose with the truth. Politico's Eugene Daniels, thank you so much for being here this morning. Have a great weekend. The Texas abortion law that has effectively banned the procedure in the state remains in place after the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday declined to reinstate the ban on enforcement. By a 2-1 vote, the appellate panel refused the Justice Department's request to restore the district court's suspension of the statute. The DOJ can now appeal the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Washington Post reports the order follows a temporary decision last week by the same panel of judges to reinstate the ban, less than 48 hours after it was suspended by the lower court judge. The decision was based on a previous rulings in a separate challenge, which said that because the ban is enforced by private individuals and not government officials, it is not clear when and how the law can be challenged in federal court. More than 10,000 union members at John Deere walked off the job yesterday. It's the latest walkout for a resurgent labor movement across the country, with workers frustrated with long hours during the pandemic and what it sees as soaring corporate profits that are not trickling down. That, in addition to the supply chain crisis, a worker shortage, and mounting concerns about the U.S. economy. NBC News correspondent Gabe Gutierrez has more.
In Ottumwa, Iowa, members of the United Auto Workers walk the picket line, kicking off the nation's largest private sector strike in 2 years.
It's a resurgence of the labor movement. You know, the cheap labor bubble is finally busted.
Chris Larson has worked for John Deere for almost two decades. More than 10,000 union members like him, employees at 14 plants across five states, rejected a deal that included 5 to 6% wage hikes. The workers argue they deserve more since the company has reported record profits this year, $4.7 billion so far.
This is the first time that the deck has been stacked in our favor. We know it.
A John Deere spokesperson says we will keep working day and night to understand our employees' priorities and resolve this strike. But the walkout is underway during harvesting season when many farmers need parts for their equipment. It's also smack in the middle of a supply chain crisis, many factors colliding as the American worker decides to fight back.
The president believes in collective bargaining rights, believes in workers' rights, believes that's the role that labor unions and why they are so important to our country.
Marie Rotaco has been a nurse in Massachusetts for nearly 40 years. She's been on strike for 7 months.
I think the pandemic has awakened the union movement again. And I think that people are realizing what their worth is.
Across several states, a strike at cereal giant Kellogg is entering its second week. While in a very different industry, Hollywood, 60,000 behind-the-scenes workers are threatening to strike as soon as next Monday. Crew members are calling for higher pay, better benefits, and meal breaks. In August alone, 4.3 million workers quit their jobs, a record, some analysts calling it the Great Resignation.
A lot of people suffered greatly during the pandemic in terms of work hours, difficult work conditions, and so forth. So there is exhaustion, and there is an opportunity to come and negotiate, renegotiate terms.
Our thanks to NBC's Gabe Gutierrez for that report. And still ahead, Moderna gets one step closer to receiving clearance from the FDA for its COVID-19 booster shot. Plus, despite pandemic burnout, nursing schools are seeing a surge in applications. Those stories and a check on the weather when we come right back.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock. Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
An FDA advisory panel voted unanimously to recommend emergency use authorization of a booster dose of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. This is just the first step towards authorization, with the CDC set to give its approval early as next week. NBC News national correspondent Miguel Almaguer has the latest.
Moving a major step toward authorization, an FDA advisory panel says some Americans fully vaccinated with Moderna should get its booster. The unanimous recommendation, not yet greenlit by the CDC, applies to those 65 and older, and others at higher risk of severe disease because of health conditions or exposure at their job.
I think we all expected a third shot was going to be prescribed for those at high risk. The question here is, did the science appear to justify such a decision?
Providing documents full of data, Moderna argued the FDA should authorize its booster for recipients at least 6 months after their second dose, citing breakthrough infections and waning immunity over time. But the FDA notes even without a booster, vaccines still afford protection against severe COVID-19 disease and death in the United States.
There's been some pushback against Moderna because its efficacy against hospitalization remains high. So why the need for a booster?
The vaccines are still working for the vast majority of Americans. It's keeping people out of the hospital. It's keeping people from being infected. they're not in urgent need of a booster.
With nearly 70 million Americans already fully vaccinated with Moderna, those who qualify join the same group of Pfizer recipients who can also get a booster. With Moderna's original doses larger than Pfizer's, its third shot will be a half dose. Authorities saying the data are not perfect, but these are extraordinary times. The president again making the sell for boosters.
These boosters are free. I'll say it again, they're free, available, and convenient to get.
As Johnson & Johnson's case for a booster comes up, millions vaccinated with Moderna, the extra dose of protection may soon be a shot away.
Nurses across the country are quitting their jobs, but yet applications to nursing schools are on the rise. Nationally, enrollment in nursing programs increased nearly 6% last year from 2019 to more than 250,000 students. This as hospitals report thousands of experienced nurses left their positions because of the burnout they experienced from battling the COVID pandemic. School officials say the surge is due to young people seeing the pandemic as an opportunity and a challenge. Educators believe the higher enrollment could help ease a nursing shortage that existed even before COVID-19. Meanwhile, in a significant step to address the growing healthcare worker shortage, the Biden administration has announced that it will direct $100 million to the National Health Service Corps, one of the nation's biggest investments in healthcare program, and a fivefold increase from previous years. The funds will be directed from the American Rescue Plan that the president signed earlier this year. The NHS helps place doctors in communities that have difficulty recruiting and retaining them. The announcement comes after statistics reveal that the healthcare industry saw its biggest job losses last month, losing more than 17,000 employees. Overall, the U.S. has lost more than 500,000 healthcare workers since the start of the pandemic last year. Still ahead, the NLCS is finally set, but it took a questionable call to end the division series. We'll show you that final dodgy swing that has Giant fans up in arms next in sports.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Giants have a shift on. They're expecting Bellinger to pull it on the ground. Crawford closest to the bag. Here's a 1-2 and a shot into right center. A base hit for Bellinger. Justin Turner will score. Lux to third. Cody Bellinger delivers in the clutch.
Cody Bellinger delivers a big hit for the Dodgers in the ninth inning, breaking a tie with the Giants with an RBI single. Clinging to a one-run lead, the Dodgers then turn to ace Max Scherzer coming out of the bullpen to close out the most important inning of their season.
No balls, two strikes. And Flores, did he go?
He did! And the game ends! A swinging strike three!
No.
Gabe Morales rings him up. The game is over, and the Los Angeles Dodgers are headed to the National League Championship Series.
Scherzer, making just the 14th relief appearance of his career, earns his first save and sends the Dodgers to the National League Championship Series with a 2-1 win over San Francisco. But as you can see, there's some controversy over that final out. The strike three call coming on a disputed check swing to end the game. But per rules, that play is not renewable. I'm not sure he went there. And that's certainly a tough way to end not just a classic game, but a terrific series between two teams that won over 106 games. And we just saw it again. That does not look like strike three. He should get, Wilmer Flores should have gotten at least one more pitch. I am sorry to Giants fans. That is a tough way for a magical season to end. The Dodgers now advance to face the Atlanta Braves in the best of seven NLCS. Game one is tomorrow night. Meanwhile, America's team, the Boston Red Sox, will visit the Houston Astros tonight for Game 1 of the American League Championship Series. I'm already very nervous. Meanwhile, some coaching shakeups among teams now eliminated from the postseason. Despite a team record 17-game winning streak that carried the Cardinals into the National League wildcard game, that team has fired manager Mike Schilt. That winning streak was in September. That was not long ago. The Cardinals' president of baseball operations cited philosophical differences as the reason for the manager's dismissal. In New York, Aaron Boone is so far safe in his position as Yankee manager. But after the team's third place finish in the AL East and lost to the rival Red Sox in the AL wildcard game, the Yankees will not renew the contracts of at least two of the coaches under him. ESPN reports the deal that for a third assistant coach, also not going to be renewed. So a shakeup there. Boone, for now, still has his job. Turning to the NFL and the Eagles hosting the Buccaneers to kick off week 6. To Philadelphia, the defending champions never trailed in the game. Quarterback Tom Brady tossed touchdown passes on Tampa's first two drives, leading the Bucs to a 21-point lead in the third quarter. Then, after a pair of rushing scores from running back Leonard Fournette. The Buccaneers improved to 5-1 with a 28-22 victory over the Eagles. That Tom Brady, this just in, he's still really good. Time now for the weather. Let's go to meteorologist Bill Cairns, like Tom Brady, another ageless wonder. Bill, what's it look like out there?
Yeah, I get it. You know, you don't want balls and strikes to be reviewable, but like in the playoffs, like that's, ugh. Yeah, I know. That was Bill, a hard way to go. I mean, the guy was on
for sure. There's been a real scrutiny on umpires this postseason, even more than usual, and there's certainly a growing momentum to sort of have robot umps or some sort of automated system to call balls and strikes. And that, you know, that check swing there, that's a real tough way to end a game.
Yeah, I mean, I get the rule, but maybe change it for the postseason. So maybe they will after the season. So, yeah, great year by the Giants, by the way. You know, 109 wins total? Crazy. All right, so let's get into this forecast because it's going to change. If you've been on the East Coast enjoying all the warm, gorgeous weather, this is the weekend that reality kind of kicks back in. So we got the cool air that's coming out of the West. Right now, we're still very warm in the East. In the middle, we have showers and thunderstorms, and that's going to be the cold front that changes things. We have downpours right now in northern Indiana heading for Detroit, Toledo. There's a pretty good round of storms also right around Missouri, where Missouri and Arkansas meets. So this is how it's going to play out during the day today. Numerous areas of showers and storms, northern Mississippi, Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, all the way through Ohio. Definitely umbrella weather for you. Same with Chicago. Bring it with you. Then tonight through the overnight hours, that rain moves through Ohio, West Virginia. You're going to wake up to a rainy Saturday morning in Buffalo, Rochester to Pittsburgh. And then these storms on Saturday afternoon are going to sweep towards the East Coast. You'll have a period of rain during the afternoon in D.C. and Baltimore. Looks like Philly and New York, it'll be mid to late afternoon. I paused this at 8 p.m. as that heavy rain will be arriving in areas like Hartford and Springfield, Mass. New Hampshire and Vermont look for a rainy Saturday afternoon. And then these storms will sweep out Saturday night. So Sunday will be better in New England than it will be on Saturday. Unfortunately, today, some of these storms could be strong. 25 million people are at risk of severe weather today, mostly damaging wind, maybe an isolated tornado or two. That's from Arkansas all the way through the Ohio Valley. Then on Saturday, isolated strong storms in the Northeast. I don't think there's going to be a severe weather outbreak, but some of those storms could have some gusty winds. So for today's forecast, probably the warmest day we're going to have till next spring in areas of the Northeast. 80 today in New York, 84 in D.C. But then things change as that rain moves through on Saturday. Notice the rest of the country is kind of tranquil. Beautiful weather from the plains all the way down through Texas. And then on Sunday, that's when the much cooler weather will arrive in the Northeast. Finally feeling like fall, but we kind of have to pay for it a little bit on Saturday with those storms, Jonathan.
84 degrees here in D.C. on October 15th is an outrage. And no need to check the forecast for that Red Sox-Astros game. It's in Houston. They play in a dome. Bill Cairns, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. And coming up, when it comes to the president's infrastructure plans, how will Democrats get to a number they can all agree on? Will Biden have to make the final call? We'll talk about that ahead. But before we go to break, we want to know, why are you awake? Email your reasons to waytooearly@msnbc.com or tweet me at John Lemire using the hashtag waytooearly. We'll read some of our favorite answers later in the show. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's just after 5:30 on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Jonathan Lemire. President Biden has signed a bill extending the debt ceiling just days before the Treasury says the U.S. would have defaulted for the very first time. The short-term bill will only last until December. House Democrats passed the bill earlier this week without any support from the GOP, despite the hike being necessary to pay for spending accrued under the previous Republican president. This, as the White House is reportedly losing patience with Democrats as negotiations for their social spending bill drags on. NBC News has confirmed earlier reporting from Punchbowl News that the Biden administration feels they need to wrap up talks soon and agree on a reconciliation package. In order for Democrats to pass the president's Build Back Better agenda, our next guest says it might be time for Biden to knock some heads on Capitol Hill. Joining us now, staff writer at The New Republic, Daniel Strauss. Daniel, good morning. Great to see you. Welcome to the show. Let's talk about your take here. What does the president need to do to pass these bills? How would he get tougher? What would that look like?
I mean, that's the question that the White House is weighing right now. They so far have tried to give the Hill and members of Congress a lot of latitude in figuring out some kind of bill that is inclusive to all factions of the Democratic Party. But we're still without an infrastructure bill and a reconciliation package that's moving to the next step in Congress. So very recently, at all levels of the White House, there have been signals that time is running out. They're tapping their watches and saying tick-tock, tick-tock. It's not really clear what Biden could do at this point. He's done a lot that the White House can do. He's had Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin over in the Oval Office multiple times for one-on-one meetings. He has held caucus meetings. He has tried to broker some kind of compromise. And yet, here we are. So at this point, the White House is weighing just finally like blowing a whistle and saying, this is the top line number. You guys need to pass something now. Not everyone is going to be happy, but that's the race.
Right. There was certainly some frustration from House Democrats, particularly the moderates, who say they were really calling for, on the record, calling for the president to take more of an aggressive stance here, to keep saying that he was doing too much listening and not enough directing. And it does seem, to your point, that his own personal outreach has really picked up in recent days, including to Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Sinema's office said yesterday that she'd been in contact with the White House frequently over the last few days. But yet, the two of them, West Virginia and Arizona senators, are still holding out and seem to want pretty different things. How does this all end? How does the White House thread the needle with those two and not alienate all the progressives in the House?
Well, one thing we do know is that the word is that they seem to be getting closer with at least Sinema. And the thing about Joe Manchin is that he and Sinema are both some of the most moderate Democrats on Capitol Hill, but Manchin usually in the end comes around with his party. Sinema's a bit more of a cipher, but the signals we've heard is that she is coming around on sort of her priorities, which are the environment and a top line number. It's still pretty unclear, but there have been faint signals that she's coming to some kind of compromise. So the White House seems to think that this can end soon. It's not clear how. We do know that the top line number will almost certainly come down from the $3.5 trillion price tag where it's been for the past few weeks.
Right. I think there's a number here in Washington who seem to think that final number, Dana, will end up perhaps around $2 trillion, maybe a touch more. And the question is, will that be enough for the progressives? Dan Strauss, we appreciate your being here. We'll have you back soon for sure. Thank you and have a great weekend. Still ahead, the local news report giving a totally different meaning to the term rolling coverage. Way Too Early is back in just a minute. Time now for something totally different. The infamous self-shredding artwork by British street artist Banksy has just sold at auction for, wait for it, $25.4 million. The artwork famously shred itself after it sold at auction 3 years ago, then for the sale price of just $1.4 million. Sotheby's received some criticism at the time for failing to spot the hidden shredder. The 2018 buyer decided to go through with the purchase, a decision that paid off, as we can see, as the artwork's price soared. Cher is not singing I've Got You, Babe to Sonny Bono's Widow. The singer filed a breach of contract federal lawsuit in Los Angeles this week that alleges former Representative Mary Bono and other defendants have attempted to terminate provisions in a business agreement made between the two stars when they got divorced back in 1975. The agreement stated that each were entitled to 50% of all songwriting and recording royalties of their music. The lawsuit says that Sonny Bono's heirs filed notice in 2016 that they were terminating some of his song licensing agreements, but they, quote, did not terminate and could not have terminated his agreements with Cher. The lawsuit alleges that Cher deserves $1 million in damages. The attorney for Mary Bono said that the family is within their right and the law, according to the Copyright Act. Cher and Sonny Bono were married from 1969 to 1975. And meanwhile, Detroit reporter Victor Williams is going viral for giving a live report while skateboarding. Take a look.
And so Mr. Premium is going to be out here every single Monday and Wednesday skateboarding with everyone and trying his best to basically show them exactly what to do. As far as Chandler Skate Park, they'll be done in about the next 10 days or so.
Williams has been skateboarding since he was little. So when local NBC station WDIV covered a story about construction at a local skate park, they knew just who to send. That is extraordinarily impressive. And I'll tease, at 6 a.m., Willie Geist will be doing the same on Morning Joe. Still ahead, the next steps for holding Steve Bannon accountable after he blew off a House deposition. Way Too Early is coming right back. The process for holding Steve Bannon and any other select committee witnesses who fail to comply with the subpoena is both straightforward and longstanding. First, the January 6th Select Committee would vote on whether to find him in contempt. Once the contempt resolution passes the committee, it would be referred to the full House for a vote. If the House finds the person in contempt, Speaker Nancy Pelosi must then refer the matter to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia for criminal prosecution. The law says the U.S. Attorney shall present the contempt finding to a federal grand jury for prosecution, but the Justice Department has always said it has full discretion on whether to seek said prosecution. If the prosecution goes forward and Bannon is convicted, he faces a $1,000 fine and up to a year in jail. It's worth noting that even if Bannon were convicted, the committee would still lack his testimony. Conviction for criminal contempt of Congress does not force the witness to comply with the subpoena. So that's the process. We're walking you through it. And joining us now to help, the professor at the professor of history at New York University, Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is the author of the book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Professor, good morning. Thank you so much for being here. The history of criminal prosecution for contempt of Congress doesn't really seem to be on Congress's side. And even if Bannon were to be convicted, they wouldn't have his testimony. Is there anything about Bannon's refusal to comply that might change what happens here?
You know, if you grow up in a democracy, it can be hard to get into the lawless mentality of somebody like Bannon. And it's completely unsurprising that he did not, you know, he's defying the subpoena, because responding to a subpoena means that you are legitimizing democratic institutions, you're accepting the rule of law. And Bannon intends to overthrow our democracy. He's very open about this. And so we should hold him in contempt, because Congress should hold him in contempt, because he has only contempt for our institutions. The other thing is, he's doing this at the request of Trump. And he's indebted to Trump because Trump pardoned him. And authoritarians always pardon people at strategic moments. And so Bannon is actually doing the job that Trump pardoned him to do, which has helped Trump to take down democracy.
Professor, is there any sort of historical parallels we can look to here, other moments where someone like this refused to comply with a legislative body as they were seeking testimony? Or are we in uncharted territory?
No, in Italy, under Berlusconi, which is a very good parallel, because he never wrecked democracy, but he bent it around his little finger. He would do things like running out the clock. He was in innumerable criminal and civil corruption scandals and trials, and he demonized the press, he demonized the judiciary, he had a victim complex. And in fact, he was voted out in 2006, and the center-left came in, this is the equivalent of Biden, and they didn't want to prosecute Berlusconi because they feared it would look partisan and they wanted to turn the page. They were sick of his personality cult. And guess what happened? he came back in less than 2 years later, and he was more corrupt than ever.
Professor, we were talking earlier in the show about the possibility that Donald Trump might be called, that he might be served a subpoena. You know, you had, your book is about strongmen. Certainly some would use that term to describe the former president, or at least close to it. What do you think happens there? If that moment comes and we assume Trump refuses, what is that going to look like for the country right now? What are the stakes?
That's a great question. And there, you know, there's a lot of fear that and overcaution, because saying that, well, if Trump were indicted or prosecuted, then it plays into his victim cult. It could cause unrest because he's been, you know, mobilizing his followers. But we've already had unrest, and that's January 6th. And if you don't hold people accountable, everybody involved from Bannon to Trump, you risk, I guarantee you'll have more unrest. The other thing that history shows is that the personality cults, the authoritarian leader cults of these guys, they don't start to deflate until they're prosecuted, because prosecution shows the nation and the world that these people are not, in fact, immune. They're not, in fact, immortal and above the law. So it's very, very important. And what we do now is going to determine our fate in the years to come.
The pages of history are being written as we speak. Professor of History at New York University, Ruth Ben-Ghiat, thank you so much for being here today. Earlier in the show, we asked this: why are you awake? One viewer writes, newly retired after 21 years, 5 months, and 16 days in the Air Force. Old habits die hard. Congratulations, sir, and thank you for your service. Mike says, up shopping for glasses and looking into umpire school. After watching the game last night, I just know I could make it at MLB. You know, the more I see the highlights of that check swing, the worse that call looks. That is not how any team season should end, particularly one that won north of 106 games. And then there's Jeff. He's up preparing his fishing gear, writing, I'm going to take my boys out for the opening of trout season in Illinois tomorrow. Good luck. Hope the fish are biting. Hunter emails, I'm up way too early because I am one of those student nurses that you mentioned. Stay safe out there. Thank you, Hunter. Thank you for doing that. The nation obviously needs your help right now. Up next, the renewed effort by Democrats to advance a voting rights measure. And coming up on Morning Joe, we'll hear from Senator Tim Kaine after rallygoers in his state pledged allegiance to a flag that organizers said was present at the January 6th Capitol riot. Plus, Emmy Award-winning actress Edie Falco joins the conversation to discuss her new role portraying Hillary Clinton. Morning Joe, just a few minutes away.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.